History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and take the time to listen as memories from long ago spring to life again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Inspiration is something that was likely to be the end result for anybody who got to spend even a few minutes around the remarkable Mickey Gannich, a Pearl Harbor survivor who passed away last week at the age of 102. Mickey was always ready and willing and able to share his story because he knew it would help keep history alive. And he hoped that it would help keep America alert. Mickey was fond of saying, "Every day is Memorial Day," and he lived with that kind of reverence and resolve, selflessly giving his time and ability to anybody who would ask, in a way very few others did. He was in football pads that Sunday morning.
I was always active in sports. In fact, I played 2 years of high school, and I played 1 year of semi-pro football back there in the Akron area there. But the only jobs that's available was WPA, that's Work Progress Administration, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover determined that a way of creating jobs there. Mm-hmm. And, but I saw no future in that, and had a brother and sister living in Oakland, California, and they said, "Well, come on out there and we'll see what we can do." So I was able to get a job in the rubber company, Pacific Tire and Rubber Company in Oakland. I came to California in 1939, and then the world situation was getting so bad in 1939, 1940, that the United States had a draft. All men were 21 years and older had registered for the draft there. They said, "You register for the draft and you go into the service, you're going to the Army." They said, "You go in the Army here, you could be sleeping outside there and cold food there." And that wasn't for me, so I joined the Navy. So call me a draft dodger, too. So I joined the Navy January 21st in 1941. The next draft for the Army was going to be in the spring of 1941, so... I wasn't going to wait till I land there and see whether I was drafted or not there, and so I picked the Navy, and it wasn't steady enough work, so I gave it up after 23 years.
Only 23 years, yeah. Only the entirety of World War II and the Korean War and almost to the Vietnam War.
In fact, I was still in the service and Vietnam was going on, but I never got to Vietnam.
And here you thought by joining the Navy, you might miss out on some of the worst stuff of World War II. You didn't have to go to North Africa or the Pacific as an Army soldier, but I don't think you knew what was going to happen on December 7th of 41.
No. We were ready to play a game. We had a game. I was on the ship's football team and made the first team on. I wasn't very big. I was pretty big. I was 170 pounds there. That was big in those days. Now, if you're not 250, you're nothing there. So I joined the ship's football team, and we had a great team. And we scheduled to play USS Arizona for a fleet football championship, 1 o'clock December 7th, 1941. That was going to be the Super Bowl of the Navy. It was really important there. So we was going to do a little scrimmage and get ready for the game and leave the ship at 8 o'clock in the morning, December 7th. There was no place to change clothes. A little field was close by to us there. So we had all our padding on for the attack. When the attack came there, you go to your battle station. You don't have time to change clothes or anything. So up in the crow's nest, I went in my football uniform, all my padding on there, little trap door to get up there, pulled myself through to get up there. That was my battle station. I was a lookout. Whether you're in port or not there, mm-hmm. You go where your battle station is.
Well, and I want people to understand how jolting of an interruption this was. How long had you been at Pearl as part of the Pennsylvania's crew before that day?
I joined the USS Pennsylvania August 15th, 1941. Mm-hmm. So I was on the team for, you know, on the ship itself for about 3 months or so before the war started.
So you'd done this before. This, you know, it's a routine Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Did you have any reason to believe there was any chance of the Japanese attacking?
Well, we'd been talking for months there whether we're getting the war or not, and we figured no one would bother us there. We got 8 battleships in port there. We're powerful. A country would be crazy to try to attack us. If there would be any problem at all, it'd be in the Philippines, so we don't have to worry about it. So what the policy was during the week there, the ships would go out to sea and maneuver around, the gunnery practice and all that, and be in port on the weekends there. The whole fleet would be in port practically. The only thing is, except for the aircraft carriers were not in port. They were taking planes to Midway and Wake Island, so they were not in port. Fortunately, because that was the reason there that they were not in port, why there was no third attack, an attack on Pearl Harbor. Third attack for the aircraft carriers was the number one target, and the oil fields and repair facilities.
Which would have crippled
American
forces.
If that would have happened, we would have lost the war. We'd be talking Japanese now, because they would have took the war because the closest oil and closest repair facilities, 2,000 miles away, it would have been a disaster there. We were very fortunate, but bad weather had slowed the aircraft carriers up, and they were not in port. If it had been good weather, they'd been in port, we'd have been attacked, we'd have lost the war. It's that simple.
So let's talk about how the farm boy from Ohio experienced this. You just turned 22 a few weeks before that.
Yeah.
So you're in your football pads getting ready for a scrimmage before the big game with the Arizona at 1. And what was your first indication that the Japanese were there?
Well, the living compartment of the in fact, to be a quartermaster, let me tell you how I became a quartermaster. They asked me what I'd like to do. I got good grades. I took my education seriously. I got good grades in my tests, and they said, what would you like to do? I said, well, I'm not mechanically minded. I'd like to do something there that would not require mechanical aptitude there. They said, how you like to steer a ship? I said, that's great for me. Because back there in Ohio, the biggest thing we saw at Lake Erie was ferry boats there. And I said, oh, they said, yeah, how'd you like to steer a ship inside of the harbor, outside the harbor, out at sea? I said, that's for me. So they made me a quartermaster. So I went to quartermaster and signal school in San Diego. And then when I got on the ship there, one of the main duties there was steering the ship. And I ended up steering that 33,000-ton battleship in and out of the harbors there, all over the Pacific, it seemed like there. That's pretty good for a farm boy. And I never even saw anything bigger than a ferry boat up close. Mm-hmm. And then steer that 608 feet long, 33,000-ton battleship. I thought that was pretty good for a farm boy.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't steer it on December 7th, though, because it was in dry dock.
Yeah, that's right. We had propeller tow. Fortunately, normally when we were in port, we would tie up at a dock, 10-10 mm-hmm. dock. That's how long that dock is, 1010 feet long. We always had an admiral aboard when we went out at sea because we were the flagship of the fleet. Mm-hmm. Whenever we came in port, we tied up at the dock there. But a couple of days before that, we had propeller tow. They put us in dry dock with 2 other destroyers, casting in the Downs, saying we weren't in our normal place there. The ships have moved into the place where we normally did be. A torpedo all on the hull and I got hit. They were the place where we would be because I found out later 2 Japanese airplanes were scheduled to hit the USS Pennsylvania. They wanted to make sure they knock out the flagship ship of the fleet because, you know, in your Indian movies, you knock out the chief, you got a better chance of winning the war. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make sure that the Pennsylvania was hit. Well, the Ogallala was sunk, the Helena was damaged there, but they were aiming for us, but we weren't in our normal place, fortunately.
So for you, you started to tell me where the living quarters were and what your first alarm to this situation was.
We're going to leave a ship at 8 o'clock. It takes about 4 or 5 minutes to get from the living compartment, the quartermaster's, to get up on deck, so we leave a ship at 8 o'clock. About 6 minutes to eight, the phone rang. I picked up the phone. One of the fellows on the deck was up on deck of our gang, called on and said, Japanese attack in Pearl Harbor. I said, oh, come on, let's not talk about it. Because we'd been talking about it for months there, but we feared there was no chance for us. About that time, the ship shuddered. Some of our fellows that were close to the guns went to the guns and started shooting at the planes before we knew below decks knew what was going on. About that time, General Quarters went, all hands man your battle stations. Now, get from there up to the poles there, what you, I guess you'd call it there, the mast there with the close nest. That's where I had to go. So by the time I got up there, ships were burning, planes were burning, planes were flying around there. Look close enough, you hit them with rocks. If you had anything to throw at them, I could have thrown my binoculars at them because I was a lookout. That was all I had up there. But by the time I got up there, just a few minutes time, because you're going and you're going double time or triple time, get up there in a hurry because you don't know what was going on. It was pretty hectic.
Yeah.
But I was well protected with all my padding on.
All your football pads.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A little trap door to get through there. Pull myself through with all the padding on. I couldn't go straight through. It wasn't that wide. So I pulled myself through with my trap door and get up there. And it was kind of bad looking, seeing planes coming all around you. And it got pretty rough. But the Japanese didn't know where we were the first attack that they had, because we weren't in our normal place. But evidently, some of the Japanese pilots reported to the aircraft carrier that there's a big ship in dry dock with two other destroyers. So the second attack, they hit us. Bomb missed me by 45 feet. Armor-piercing bomb, 500-pound bomb, came on past me. I'm on the course, and it came way down, exploded way below me. If it exploded on contact, I wouldn't be here talking to you. It's kind of scary to see a big hole alongside of you there.
So but, if it had been a conventional bomb as opposed to armor-piercing, it would have gone off on the deck, and yeah, you would have been gonzo.
Yeah.
And as it stands, you're up on this crow's nest. So when that bomb detonates below deck, I'm sure that was quite an earthquake for you.
Oh, it really shook me, but we didn't know where it hit because if I saw the bomb coming, I probably died right there. It came on past me, and I saw the result of it, but I didn't see it happening.
And this whole time, because of your elevated position, you're seeing a whole lot of other things.
Yeah. In fact, my job was to look how to report anything of interest there. I could report or what it is of phones on the ship itself. It's sound-powered phones is what it is. I would see the plane coming over the top of the buildings because the building's fairly close to us, too. I saw this plane coming over the top of the buildings. I reported to it there. They turned their guns around facing that direction. When he came past his building, pow, we got him. That's the only plane we knocked down there. If they had trained the guns around to get the plane, they'd never had it, but they had the guns trained in that direction. So when the plane come over that way, they got him. They were ready for him.
And
so
you gave him a good scouting report.
Yeah. So that made me feel pretty good. I did accomplish something.
Well, and if you hadn't, that plane might have done something to your ship, too.
That's right.
You know, you hear a lot about D-Day as the longest day, but I'm wondering how long December 7th, 1941 felt for you.
It felt pretty long there, but we're just glad because in between there was about a 10-15 minute gap in between the first attack and second attack. So I had a chance to look around and get below and change clothes, get out of my football uniform on and get in my regular clothes. And then you didn't really have time to think about it, but I saw the results there. I saw the hole alongside me where the bomb came. Saw machine gun nicks in the ladder where I climbed up to get up to the crow's nest. Whether it happened before I went up there, after I went up there, or during the time I went up, I don't know, but they didn't get me. That's kind of scary, too.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't see what could have happened there, but I figured God had other plans for me. He's looking out for me.
That is a sentiment Mickey Gannett shared with anybody who would listen until taking his final breath on May 4th at the age of 102. If you're one of those who had the privilege of meeting him, or you're just touched by what you hear from him on the radio, you can send your condolences to his wife, Barbara. I have that address for you at hometownheroesradio.com. We'll revisit more of his memories from Pearl Harbor and beyond when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.